He is Donovan Bennett. Glad to have him on the program. Donovan, thank you very much for doing this today. How are you?
Good, my man. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I can't believe, and I said this before, I can't believe the number of people who have the audacity after being on video or know they're on video or know there's video evidence that have the audacity to double down on a lie. It's crazy to me the way this situation has unfolded, which could have been dealt with last summer very easily.
Yeah, man. I mean, I think as crazy as it is, it's not sadly really that surprising, right? Like when we're talking about the death of George Floyd, which is a tipping point for many people, you had a police officer who was filmed by multiple people who knew that, you know, body cam footage at some point could be in play. And he was casual and cavalier in his execution. He was so much so that he had his hand in his pocket while doing it. So it's not surprising to me because, you know, we've seen and heard these stories all of the time. Now what has changed in the 21st century is we have videotape, we have footage, so that maybe people will believe when they're, you know, going into courts and it's their word against a police officer. That's a really tough position to be put in. But also the difference in this specific case is Masai Ujiri has the means to fight back. Not only, you know, was he done wrong, but also he was smeared and made to seem like he was a criminal. And so because he has those means, because he is able to fight in the judicial system, because he can lawyer up in a way that other people can't, he most likely will have a positive outcome in what is a negative scenario. But many people don't have the ability to have lawyers at their behest whenever they need. They need the help of public defenders who are overworked and underpaid and many times are just looking to settle cases because they have a huge caseload. And then when you settle, all of a sudden you have a criminal record for something that you didn't do, and all of a sudden you can't get employment the way you wish you could, and all of a sudden you can't vote in certain places the way you should. So you see how this situation with the jury is so unfair, but it's actually even worse for many other people who share the same pigmentation that he does. And I think that's why this moment is so important to talk about these things, because Masai will be okay. His day was ruined in terms of him being able to celebrate with the Larry O'Brien Trophy the way he should have, but his life won't be ruined, and that's not the case for many others.
Yeah, you make very good points, and what's interesting about it is that I got the sense of when things were unfolding, a prosecutor said there's nothing here last summer, that Masai Ujiri was just going to let this go, and he's the one who had every right to pursue it further, and yet he was going to just say, you know what? It's an unfortunate incident. I'm not going to let that ruin things. And it's the other guy who not only is in the wrong to begin with, but then basically tries to commit fraud here.
Yeah, and it's funny you use the word fraud, because this is someone who, you know, was implicated in insurance fraud before, right? So this is literally someone who's being paid handsomely, by the way, to serve and protect. And in this very instance, he's there to serve and protect the teams, the players, the coaches, and the executives, and Masai would be one of them. So not only does he do the opposite of what his task is for that day, but he turns it into, as you say, a fraudulent case, claiming that he was injured, claiming that he had mental unrest since and accrued over $100,000 in workers' compensation, not being able to work and being off duty since the incident because of it. And this is someone who's already had fraud in their past. And so it begs the question, when we're talking about these issues, we're not talking about just rogue actors and rogue bad cops. We're talking about a system that needs to be overhauled. And if someone like this can be employed to serve and protect, despite the red flags in their past and also the current behavior that is suspect at best, that's why people need to really have a conversation on, should we be overhauling the entire system and starting from scratch?
Donovan Bennett of Sportsnet joining us this morning on the Scott Rintoul Show. I was talking about the Raptors yesterday, and I am not a card-carrying member of Jurassic Park. I don't have anything against the Raptors, but I'm not going to pretend that I have this emotional investment in them. That's just not where my fandom, when I'm not doing my job, happens to lie. But man, do I respect the Raptors. You don't have to be a Patriots fan to understand that's a good organization. You don't have to be a Raptors fan to understand that is a good organization. And I thought even the details, Donovan, that they had in their return to play for these playoffs with the anthem, which certainly reflected the stance that the organization has on these important matters that we're talking about with racial justice and the way that they did the players' families doing the intro. Man, they understand everyone in that organization. I don't know if I saw Kyle Lowry smile that big when they won the trophy last year. They know how to hit all the right notes, don't they?
They do, and it's a great point because those little small details, they matter. They matter in a large way, and specifically when you have the entire league, well, the league, the best teams in the league, the best 22 teams in the league in the bubble, when they've got same access to resources. They're basically, everyone has a blank canvas. And what the Raptors have done, they've gone above and beyond to make their players feel comfortable, make their players feel at home, their floor in the hotel. It's called Raptorville. There are signage and posters all over the floor as soon as you get off the elevator, literally on the doors of the elevator, to make them feel like they're at Scotiabank, to make them feel like they're in Toronto and in Canada. Now, when you have 37 members of your staff there, who's putting that signage up? It's a every man and woman has to help task. So we had the president, Masai Ujiri, and the GM, Bobby Webster, and the head of security, and the head of PR, all doing this for the players to make sure they felt comfortable, they felt at home. When the players went in the rooms and checked in for the first time, there were photos there of their families. So, again, we understand what we're asking you to do is incredibly difficult. We are going to try and make it as palatable as we can. And we know family is important. So we're not just going to say 1, 2, 3 family when we break the huddle. We're actually going to mean it and be intentional about it, that our organization is going to be a family. And then you saw it with the opening, the introduction for the players, and how could you not be inspired if you're a player on that team, if you got that? How can you not be inspired if you're a player on the bench saying, man, I want to start because I want that treatment from my family? And there's no question that Kyle Lowry starts the game by draining a three, and that Fred VanVleet has his best playoff game ever, one of the best playoff games from a guard ever, because they saw their kids and they saw, oh, that's right, this is why I'm playing. It's for them. This is why I'm making that sacrifice. So a first-class organization, top-down, literally top-down, is working hard in the bubble to make sure their players are in the best possible position to succeed. And this Nets series, everything's come full circle. When they played the Nets in the playoffs at the beginning of the We the North movement, not many people were thinking of the Raptors as the prototype, the first-class organization in the NBA. Now they're in the bubble with all of the other teams, and they are now the envy of the NBA because they're doing and taking care of the small things like you mentioned.
A year ago, the Raptors lost their opening game. Turned out just to be a blip. Milwaukee lost to the same franchise. Orlando yesterday, maybe just a blip. The Lakers lost to Portland. Is there more than just a blip there?
I think so. I mean, the Lakers' half-court offense has been one of the worst since we've had a restart now. They're going through the motions. They knew they were going to be the number one seed. But the difference is the team they're playing in Portland, you know, if healthy, they wouldn't be an 8 seed. They would be a 4 or 3 seed. They got Yusuf Nurkic back. He's playing at an extremely high level. Carmelo Anthony has found the fountain of youth. And Damian Lillard continues to get better before our eyes. So I do think that it's more than a blip for the Lakers or for the Bucks, even though the Raptors stubbed their toe against the Magic, and then it was a gentleman's sweep after that, because these playoffs are very unique. No travel, and broadcasters who want the games coming fast and furious to make up for the fact that they went 4 months without games. And so you're playing every 48 hours. So the compact schedule means you want to, if you're the higher seed, take care of business as soon as possible, get as much rest as possible between round 1 and round 2, because there's going to be a compound attrition as we go through the playoffs at this incredibly fast pace to make sure we get all the games in before a potential second wave. And so unlike, you know, first round series where sometimes there's 2, even 3 days in between first round games to spread them out so that all of the TV providers get a little bit of love in prime time. No, this is the opposite. This is the March Madness tournament NBA style. And I do think that if Orlando and Portland hang around and really push the Lakers and Milwaukee, they don't have to necessarily even upset them. That will make the road to a title that much more difficult and taxing on two teams that, like the Raptors, are somewhat aging.
One of Sportsnet's five tool players, Donovan Bennett, joining us here today. Television, radio, multiple podcasts, in addition to written form. He hosts the Waggle podcast on the CFL.ca as well. And I did want to bring you on as a former university football player, someone who cares about the league, and talk about where we're at with the Canadian Football League, which got the inevitable news I think we all figured was coming, though weren't hoping was coming. We're having this discussion right now with certain teams in hockey. Okay, what's essential to winning? What is essential to success? When it comes to the Canadian Football League, because of where we find ourselves right now, and there have been plenty of forks, you and I both know that, in the history of the league, as they can go one way, they can go the other. Almost everything should be up for discussion right now. To you, what is essential to the Canadian Football League, not available for discussion, but beyond that, we can talk about anything else?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Certainly good quarterback play because it's such a throwing league. But I do think that, you know, maybe what has been essential historically won't necessarily be as essential moving forward. I think this is a terrible time for many businesses in Canada, the CFL included. But I do think it's a time for the league to really reimagine itself and reinvent itself and think strategically about what the next 100 years of the CFL could look like, and to be quite frank, has to look like if it is going to exist. The model that the league is based on right now is one where turnstiles turn dollars, and teams basically are profitable by how they do at the gate, which is very volatile given not just the pandemic, but, you know, in different parts of our country, that gate in terms of how many fans you have in stands for nine games, it's impacted by weather, it's impacted by how other sports teams may or may not do in your city. It's impacted by, quite frankly, how good the product is any given year. And so I think this is a chance for the league to diversify the revenue streams. Certainly TV is one. They've had a very good relationship with our friends at Bell and TSN. But you need to find others. And so whether that's in the digital space, whether that's finding relationships with third-party apps, whether it's, you know, some unique marketing and social media, the league has to find some other ways to find unique revenue. But more importantly, more than anything, unique viewers, unique audience. Far too often when I go to a CFL game and I look to the left and look to the right, I don't see a lot of people that look like me in terms of my age. I see a lot of people with you know, gray hair, and a lot of people that are older. And so the CFL has to find a way to maybe not worry about our generation because our habits are pretty ingrained, but start to reach out to that young generation so that it is part and parcel with your sports viewing experience, being a CFL fan and being, quite frankly, a football fan. And so I think the fans are the lifeblood of the league. You see that across the prairies, the heart of the league. And you see that for the love and attention and yearning for a CFL team in the Maritimes. The CFL needs to build on that, but they have to figure out a way to find some new fans, whether it's new Canadians or young Canadians. And I do think that this pause that the league is under will give them time to not worry about a season and not worry about figuring out a Grey Cup, to figure out how do we come back in 2021 to make sure that we are strong and viable moving forward well after 2021.
Yeah, and two things that should be no-brainers for me, but will take a lot of discussion. There needs to be revenue sharing among the teams for me moving forward. I think that's the only viable financial model for long-term success. I also think there needs to be a percentage-based agreement as far as revenue goes with the players. That's where we are in the modern game. The ratio is always a flashpoint. Should the ratio of Canadian players on rosters in starting lineups be up for discussion?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think it's changing the profit margin any. If you had more Americans playing the Canadian game, I don't think you'd have more people motivated to watch. I don't think the level of play would go up significantly. On the flip side, I do think actually the tie to Canadians going to see someone that went to the university in your town or that grew up in your neighborhood, I think that is a draw, and that is a differentiator between the CFL and other leagues of its ilk. So I do think that's important. So until we get to a point where we aren't producing enough Canadian football players that can play at that level, I don't think the ratio really needs to be up for discussion, because I don't think it is hurting profits at all. I think if anything, it could be helping them. What I've seen in terms of the level of play of amateur football in university football, both at the U Sports level, but the Canadians that are going and playing in the NCAA, the level of Canadian players has never been better, ever. And so I think if anything, I think the CFL should lean in more and promote that fact and have a stronger tie and bond with the amateur football players in the country, which I know they're trying to have. And so I think that's something to watch for.
It's a fair point, and it's a good one. So it begs the question, because the three biggest markets in Canada are the one that struggle the most for attendance right now. Should those franchises be located closer to university towns, in university towns? Can it work in Toronto? Would Montreal be better in Laval than it is in Montreal? Vancouver, I'm not sure that there's an equivalent city to locate it to, but what do we do with those particular franchises?
I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that the franchises that you mentioned have a similar product in the market in terms of interest and attention, and that's the MLS. And so right at that level, in terms of what you're going to be paying to get your entertainment dollar, you have a baked-in competitor. And those cities, to be honest, just have more competitors in terms of your entertainment dollar, whether it's concerts and festivals, the arts and plays and theaters. And so naturally, it's going to be a more difficult fight in those cities, just because, there's more people trying to get attention of a consumer, and we live in the attention economy. You mentioned the relationship with universities, and I actually think that could be a road path to success to expand upon those things. For example, how good would it be before a Montreal Alouettes game, let's say on Labor Day, to have an undercard of the Caribbean playing a big game, in stadium before, and you're hopefully getting some Caribbean fans coming and enjoying the Alouettes product, and vice versa. Doing that across the country, maybe you have, the Red and Blue Bowl of York and UFT at BMO before an Argos game, or you have, UBC's homecoming against a rival, whoever's really good at the Can West at that time, before a Lions game. I do think that the U Sports product and the CFL product, they have some of the same struggles in big markets in our country. I think the two of them would realize, if they work together, that there are some synergies there where they can find some common solutions.
Another very good point. We could do this all day. I'm always unfortunate that we run out of time when we have these discussions, but we'll do it again soon. Donovan, keep up the great work on all of the platforms you're working on right now, and we'll have you back on this show sometime soon. Thank you, sir.
Please do. I always enjoy the time with you.